You're with SBS Radio.
World of Difference. You're with NITV Radio on mobile, online, and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people of the Guringai Nation and their elders, past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from freshwater to saltwater.
Hello, good afternoon. You're listening to NITV Radio and my name is Sharka Pechová. Only 2 days ago, it was January 26th, a date that's contested in our national narrative. In the program today, we continue exploring how the day was celebrated or marked around Australia with citizenship ceremonies in Canberra, events marking the 50th anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, Invasion Day and Change the Date rallies across the country. Also, Wiradjuri woman and science and technology journalist Ray Johnston will update us on some interesting developments in the scientific world, including new discoveries about coral reefs, as well as efforts to increase female participation in science and technology, and many more. And earlier this week, the federal government reached a historical agreement with the copyright owner of the Aboriginal flag. In the program, we'll look back at this development and its significance. But now let's have a look at the news for this Friday, January 28th, 2022.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Peak Indigenous bodies in the Northern Territory are calling for an immediate lockdown across Central Australia to stop the spread of COVID-19. Indigenous elder and advocate Rosalie Gunnott-Monks has died in the Northern Territory, aged 85. And in tennis, world number one Ash Barty has become the first Australian woman to make the final at her home Grand Slam since 1980. Peak Indigenous bodies in the Northern Territory have penned an open letter to the Chief Minister calling for an immediate lockdown across Central Australia to stop the spread of COVID-19. The groups include the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress, the Central Land Council, and the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance Northern Territory. They say the virus is out of control in Aboriginal communities in Alice Springs and Central Australia, and it's rapidly escalating. They have accused the territory and federal governments of a catastrophic failure to implement pre-arranged plans to control the spread of COVID-19 in Indigenous communities. They say they have been continuously advocating for firm action, but their requests have been ignored. The failures they list include not appropriately managing gatherings on New Year's Eve that became super spreader events and not relocating positive cases from overcrowded housing. They say a lockdown is the last chance to flatten the curve and prevent vulnerable or unvaccinated people from serious illness and death. Not only the Northern Territory is mourning the loss of an Indigenous elder, screen pioneer and a prominent activist, Rosalie Gunnott-Monks, who has died in the Northern Territory aged 85 on Wednesday. Ms. Gunnott-Monks starred as a teenager in the landmark 1953 film Jeddah, alongside the late Robert Tundavali. As an Anglican nun in Melbourne for 10 years, she established the first Aboriginal hostel in Victoria. The Arente and Anmadjara woman had many forays into politics and was a vocal opponent against the 2007 Northern Territory intervention instigated by the Howard government. Miss Kunoth Mong's daughter Nala says that her mother was very proud to see progress Indigenous representation on screen.
Mum was very thrilled that in her lifetime, more and more Aboriginal Australians are being portrayed on screen. And they're getting the roles. It's not like the old days where it was black paint and all that put on people to pretend to be us. Now it's, we're there. We're in people's faces, and Mum loved that.
Actor Rob Collins said Miss Kunoth Mong was an inspiration for him as well as for generations of Indigenous actors.
Seeing Rosalie and Robert Sadowali on screen and thinking, yeah, like anything is possible. And that will be her legacy for generations of Indigenous actors to come.
Rosalie Kunoth Mong died in hospital in Alice Springs on Wednesday, January 26th, after suffering a series of strokes, and is survived by her daughter and grandchildren, who will dearly miss her. The federal opposition has renewed calls for COVID-19 vaccination data for young Indigenous children to be disclosed. It comes as the overall First Nations vaccination rate lags by almost 20%. Journalist Ray Johnston reported on NITV.
Labor's Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, says she will demand clarity about first doses for under 12s. She's also pushing for a summary to be provided of adult booster rates when federal parliament resumes next month. Ms. Burney says it's unacceptable that COVID-19 vaccination data for the 5 to 11 age group is not being reported. Roughly 75% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders aged 16 and over have had two doses, compared to 93% for the general Australian population.
Authorities are investigating whether culturally significant Aboriginal rock carvings on Tasmania's rugged northwest coast have been deliberately damaged. The state's Park and Wildlife Service received a report on Monday that petroglyphs at Sundown Point appeared to have changed. Officers from the Natural Resources and Environment Department are examining if part of the site has been dislodged by tides or removed. Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania Chair Michael Mansell says the carvings are made in a harder rock than others in the region, making it unlikely the damage was caused by the sea. The Federal Environment Minister Susan Ley says a new funding pledge for the Great Barrier Reef will support tourism operators, scientists, Indigenous and local communities. The Prime Minister Scott Morrison will visit the Great Barrier Reef to announce the government pledge of $1 billion for the World Heritage Site. The government last year successfully lobbied to keep the reef off UNESCO's endangered list, and Queensland will be a key battleground for the major parties in the upcoming federal election. Environment Minister Susan Ley has told the ABC the new money is about protecting the reef.
This money is about protecting the reef. It's about maintaining the gold standard of management that we have internationally. It's about backing the communities. So we really know that this money will land in communities where it counts. And it will be on the ground, making sense, supporting the environment.
The NRL has lauded Indigenous star Josh Adokar for highlighting racist abuse he received on social media, confirming the matter has been referred to the police. The Canterbury Bulldogs record posted screenshots this week showing multiple vile comments and direct messages from a social media user. NRL Chief Executive Andrew Abdo says fans who racially abuse or threaten players will be reported to police and that the league will work with authorities to identify perpetrators. And in tennis at the Australian Open, world number one Ash Barty has become the first Australian woman to make the final at her home Grand Slam since Wendy Turnbull achieved the same feat at Koyong in 1980. Barty won 6-1, 6-3 against 2017 US Open finalist Madison Keys in 62 minutes. Barty now meets American Danielle Collins in the women's final on Saturday night, after she defeated Polish 7th seat winner Iga Swiatek in 2 seats. Barty told Channel 9 she's thrilled to have made it this far.
It's just incredible. I love this tournament. I love coming out here and playing in Australia. And as an Aussie, we're exceptionally spoiled that we're a Grand Slam nation. We get to play at home. We get to play in our backyard. And I'm just happy that I get to play my best tennis here. I enjoy it. I've done well before. And now we have a chance to play for a title. It's unreal.
And let's have a look at today's weather. Broome showers, likelihood of a storm with the tops of 33. Perth, sunny and 35 degrees. Adelaide, morning shower or 2 and 27. Melbourne, possible storms with heavy falls and 32. Hobart, humid with showers and 26 degrees. Albury, Wodonga, also humid with a possibility of a storm and 32 degrees. Canberra, shower or 2 and a possible storm, 29 degrees. Sydney, partly cloudy and 29. Newcastle, also partly cloudy and also 29 degrees. Brisbane, possible morning shower and 30 degrees. Townsville, rain at times, possible storm and 29 degrees. Cairns, rain at times and a possibility of a storm with 30 degrees. Darwin, showers with a possibility of a storm and 31 degrees. Alice Springs can expect a shower or two with possible storm with the tops of 36 degrees. And Torres Strait Islands today are partly cloudy with a chance of showers, and there's a chance of a thunderstorm in the evening with the tops of 29 degrees. With Australia emerging from lockdowns, citizenship ceremonies returned in earnest with 400 being held around the country on Australia Day. The day has been a solemn occasion for Indigenous Australians with mixed emotions for many in the community.
Day 2022, more than 16,000 people from over 150 nations attended ceremonies around the country to become Australian citizens. In Canberra, on the shores of Lake Ballygriffin, 29 of Australia's newest citizens were welcomed in one of 400 ceremonies held across the nation. Prime Minister Scott Morrison welcomed them with this message.
Like so many before you, you add your threads to Australia's rich tapestry. You now write your own chapters in Australia's story. In recent times, our national story has once again been one of terrible and great hardship. Times of loss, drought, floods, fires, the global pandemic, and the recession and hardship it has caused. And at such times, we are sustained by many things, our family, our friends, our community, our faith, and we are thankful. I'm just thankful to be an Australian and to live in Australia with my family, this land we call home.
Scott Morrison also used his speech to pay tribute to Indigenous Australians.
We recognise Indigenous peoples right across our land, from the Torres Strait Islander people in the north to the Palawa in Tasmania, to the Whadjuk Noongar people, across the Nullarbor in Perth, and the Larrakia people in the top end. Like the country itself, Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are diverse, they're unique, and they connect us through time. And here in our capital, the home of the Ngunnawal people, the home of a free, democratic people, the most successful multicultural and multi-faith nation on earth.
And not far from the official ceremony in Canberra, another milestone was marked on the lawn of Parliament House.
Always was, always will be,
Aboriginal in!
Always was, always will be,
Aboriginal in!
Always was, always will be,
Aboriginal in!
January 26, 26, 2022 marked 50 years since the Aboriginal Tent Embassy was set up to urge politicians to heed the call from Indigenous Australians for self-determination. Armed with placards, plastic sheets and a beach umbrella, four young Aboriginal men, Michael Anderson, Billy Craigie, Joe Williams and Tony Curry, set up the first Aboriginal Tent Embassy. Uncle Michael Anderson is the last surviving founder of the embassy. He told NITV News it was a powerful moment.
Well, first of all, I just know we were bloody cold. We're all sitting there in the dark saying, OK, it's Canberra waking up to a different Australia.
He says he was inspired by the Gurindji walk-off, also known as the Wave Hill walk-off, a nine-year labour strike from 1966 in the Northern Territory that resulted in a win for Indigenous land rights.
And so I say to people that the embassy is deafening in its silence, yeah? But it's an eyesore for the oppressor. They don't like it, yeah? Because everybody's saying, why is it still there? And that's a question the Australian public needs to ask the parliament, ask the politicians. Why is there a need for that embassy? And that's what I'm looking back at now and saying, well, we did it. You know, we did it. We achieved something silently, yeah? Just our sheer presence was loud enough. We didn't have to do anything else.
Uncle Michael Anderson says the gains in Aboriginal activism have been whittled away over the years with less resourcing for Indigenous legal services and housing companies. He believes there's a greater need than ever for governments around Australia to listen to the aspirations of Aboriginal people.
I'm hoping that there shouldn't be any need for the embassy anymore. And I think the greatest challenge now is to have government realise that we are many nations, different language, right? We all have different priorities. We all have different understandings of our own set of aspirations and hopes. So let's start dealing with that reality, yeah, now if we're going to do a political change here and a shift in terms of where we're going.
In Sydney, on the Sydney Harbour foreshore, the national anthem was sung in both English and in the Aboriginal language of the Eora Nation. Dominic Perrottet said he wants to see acknowledgement of Indigenous history and improvement in the Close the Gap outcomes on Indigenous health, education and well-being.
In a nation that has become home to people from every corner of the globe and all walks of life, our strength is in our unity. And I do believe that the tide is turning. And for a new generation, unity is within reach. But that begins by acknowledging the truth of our past. Acknowledging that this day represents immense loss and hurt for many First Nations people. And honouring a culture which continues unbroken today, we need to be more determined than ever to create change that makes a real difference, that closes the gap and honours the dignity of every Indigenous Australian, past, present and future.
And right across the country, Indigenous Australians held Survivor Day and Invasion Day marches. Those attending the marches say they cannot celebrate January 26, a day marking the 1788 arrival of British explorers at Sydney Cove when they declared the land a British colony. During that period, large numbers of Aboriginal people were killed in the frontier wars and massacres. Researchers at the University of Newcastle have documented between 350 and 400 sites of mass killings. At the march in Sydney, Paul Francis Silva said it has been 6 years since the death in custody of his uncle David Dungai Jr. The 26-year-old died after five officers entered his cell when he refused to stop eating a packet of biscuits. At the inquest into his death, CCTV footage was played showing the officers using handcuffs before they pushed him face down on his bed and on the floor, even as he said 12 times that he could not breathe before dying. Paul Francis Silva says for him, the 26th of January will always be a day of sadness.
This morning, most Australians would have woke up, planning their barbecue with their families. Well, this morning I woke up with tears rolling down my face. You know, people would say that it happened years ago, you know, and it had nothing to do with us. It's all in regards to our ancestors. But, you know, that shows the, generational trauma that it has on the young Indigenous people here in Australia. It means nothing to me and it never will. It's a date that needs to be abolished, not changed.
And there have been 489 Indigenous deaths in custody since the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in 1991. Indigenous Australians also continue to be overrepresented in the prison system, including children as young as 10. In 2020, at least 65% of children aged between 10 and 13 who were imprisoned were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders. That is 324 out of a total of 499. In the Northern Territory, Jersey Croshaw used January 26 to continue the weekly protests of Indigenous children in the Don Dell Youth Detention Centre. The former CEO of Aboriginal Child Protection Group Strong Aboriginal Families Together told NITV News the centre must be closed immediately.
Well, what we do know about being imprisoned and having the shackles around your neck from the age of 10, it will put our children in this justice system of detention for possibly the next four decades. This is unacceptable. We know that they will never heal from this. And when you are being locked down for 21 to 24 hours a day because of shortage of staff, and they have ignored those recommendations of the Royal Commission. Time and time again, we fight, we win a little battle, we get a Royal Commission, and then it gets shelved again.
In 2017, a Royal Commission into the Protection and Detention of Children in the Territory recommended the immediate closure of the facility after investigating what they called systemic and shocking failures, including children being shackled to chairs and tear gassed. In South Australia, Aboriginal Australian Maria Carter said she is pleased to see more non-Indigenous people joining the Survivor Day marches.
We've had enough of the rape and the theft and the murder and the traumatisation of our people. We want healing, we want unity between, you know, white and black. We don't discriminate. We love everybody. We just want peace for our children and for our elders and our future generations. It's different this year. Why is that? A lot's come to light within the government, and I think that there's a lot more understanding as to what our people have been put through. And so, yeah, I'm thankful for all non-Indigenous Australians that are here today and I just want to say peace.
And federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese says Indigenous constitutional recognition is Labour's policy platform, and that means enshrining an Indigenous voice to Parliament advisory body in the constitution.
We've continued to develop as a multicultural nation and evolve, and we need to continue to do that into the future. And in order to do that, we need to recognise that our history goes back at least 60,000 years, which is why one of my priorities will be to recognise First Nations people in Australia's constitution with a constitutionally recognised voice to Parliament is a very important reform to reconcile Australia. For all of our history, we need to consider the good and the bad. We are a great nation. I look forward to us being even greater in the future.
When Australia's constitution was drafted in the 1890s, Aboriginal Australians were expressly excluded from the document. Australia's most successful referendum in 1967, with 90.77% yes vote, resulted in changing that. The outcome allowed Indigenous Australians to be counted in the census and for federal government policy and funding in Indigenous affairs. However, there remains unresolved issues of any constitutional guarantees of fair treatment or any recognition for Indigenous Australians and their rights.
That report was produced by Biwa Kwan for SBS News and presented by Bertan Tungandame for NITV Radio.
And now it's that time of the week for the latest developments in science and technology with the Wiradjuri woman and science and technology editor, Ray Johnston. Welcome to NITV Radio, Ray.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Lovely to be speaking with you again today.
Yeah, now that time to talk about technology once again. And we start with a very interesting one about the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering, ATSE, set to elevate women's leadership in STEM.
Yeah, this is really great. You know, we talk a lot about needing to get more women into STEM, and you know, there's a lot of focus on aiming at kids and young women and entry-level roles, but we really need to be focusing on putting women in those leadership decision-making positions so that it makes the STEM industries as a whole a much more welcoming place for women to enter. So the Australian government, they actually have this seven-year $41.2 million program called Boosting the Next Generation of Women in STEM. It's a fund that they've got set up, and they've partnered with the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering as the organisation to kick off the plan. And the program that they're running is called Elevate, and it's going to give 500 undergraduate and postgraduate scholarships to women in science and technology and engineering and maths. And this program, it aims to address gender inequities in STEM through fostering more women-led industry-academia collaborations in research and business, growing the skills of women in STEM, and propelling women into senior leadership, which is really important. So they're going to co-design this really pretty cool program that's going to go across industry and studies and government to upskill women with STEM qualifications, research and business expertise, so that they can lead the Australian STEM sector into the future. So this program hopefully will be a game changer for creating a more diverse and inclusive and vibrant STEM ecosystem that can not only attract women and girls into STEM, but keep them there as well, because the retention rates for women in the industry are really low. Most will leave within the first 4 years due to burnout and additional pressures put on women to overachieve in the sector because they're underrepresented. So fingers crossed this program works to get more women staying in STEM and really thriving there.
Wow, 4 years participation is really, really small in one's career that spans decades. Yeah.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then we go into the environment with coral reef connectivity. It's being said that it promotes biodiversity and fisheries conservation.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. So, coral reefs connected by the networks where larvae is spread, fish larvae, they've been found to benefit local fisheries and biodiversity conservation. So there's been more recommendations now to increase the protection of connected reefs. There was a team of international researchers that worked on this, but they were led by Macquarie University, and they identified those key characteristics of coral reef connectivity that are really crucial to supporting the benefits coral reefs provide. And this study, it found really big gaps and also opportunities for placing marine protected areas strategically on these coral reefs, rather than just going, yeah, we'll protect this area over here. They go, well, hang on a minute, why don't we protect these areas where the larvae is? Because that seems to be the most beneficial. Because the reefs receiving larvae from, you know, these really, you know, highly interconnected corridors, they're going to lots of different reefs around the area. They have a greater number of fish species. They've got more different types of fish species. And they have twice as much biomass. So when protected, they're also more resilient to human pressure. So we're learning to be smarter about how we protect the reefs. We've seen a few studies come out about this. You know, not just try to protect the reefs as a whole, which is proving almost impossible, but really focusing on what areas of the reefs need to be protected the most. So by identifying these areas, we can make better informed decisions about where those marine protected areas should be located to maximise biodiversity and also benefit the ethical fisheries as well. So some good news.
And now we go into something that's been really affecting us in the last a little bit more than two years now, COVID-19. And it appears, this is, sounds like a no-brainer for someone who really looks a little bit deeper, that countries with strict lockdown measures saw a huge reduction in air pollution.
Yeah, we thought that this might happen. We were saying it at the time, but, you know, it's one thing to anecdotally say there's a lot less cars on the road, we've probably got less pollution, and it's another thing to actually look at the data and see it solidified as a fact. And that's what we've got now. You know, countries with strict COVID-19 lockdown measures, they did see a huge reduction in pollution. And that's according to international researchers who measured this by looking at the ground level nitrogen dioxide concentrations, or NO2. So NO2, it's a really important contributor to air pollution, and human exposure is associated with respiratory infections, asthma and lung cancer as well. So we don't want a lot of NO2 around. The team, they use satellite measurements. We're seeing satellite measurements used a lot to look at global impacts at the moment. And they looked at the NO2 level changes in over 200 cities, including 65 cities without available ground level monitoring. So mostly those were lower income regions. And they found that countries with strict lockdown conditions like North America and China had reductions about a third larger than those without, which is just enormous. And NO2 decreases during lockdowns were also found to be above the recent annual average year-to-year decreases from emissions controls that we've been putting in place. So what they found, it was equivalent to about 15 years worth of reductions globally. We saw 15 years worth of reductions during that lockdown time, which is just an incredible number.
Yeah, that's incredible. But I hope we could achieve that without the lockdowns. Then that would be really a huge improvement.
It would be. Unfortunately, we've seen most of these countries, if not all, including our own, go back to pretty much the same levels as before. I'm hoping to see some studies come out about, you know, the number of people that are now working from home due to their organisations being able to adapt to allow that, and what kind of impact that has had on traffic and transport and emissions overall. So I'm sure we'll see some of those studies start to come out in the coming months and years. So I'll be keeping an eye out for those as well.
Yeah, definitely. And finally, a good question. What will it take to save the Regent Honey Eater from extinction?
Yeah, there's new research from the Australian National University, and it shows that unless conservation actions are urgently stepped up, that one of our most beautiful songbirds, the Regent Honeyeater, it will be extinct within 20 years, which is devastating. And this new study shows current, already really intensive conservation efforts, they're not enough. And a huge redoubling of the effort is needed if we are to save these birds from extinction. Now, the Regent honeyeater population, it's been decimated by the loss of over 90% of their habitats, their preferred habitats, which is woodlands. Less than 80 years ago, it was one of the most commonly encountered species. It ranged from Adelaide to Rockhampton. But now it is on track to follow the dodo into extinction, because today there are fewer than 300 regent honeyeaters left. It's one of our rarest bird species. And habitat loss, it's forced them to compete with larger species for the remaining habitats. So the ANU team, they started this large-scale project in 2015 to better understand the regent honeyeater population decline. But they found out that they're a really difficult bird to study in the wild because they're nomads and they wander really long distances to look for nectar. So it took them 6 years to do this really intensive fieldwork to discover that the bird's breeding success has declined because of predators at the nest by species like pied currawongs, noisy miners, and also possums. So the team, they built population models using all of the available knowledge to predict what will happen to the wild population of these birds. And they do show that the current conservation efforts have provided some really essential life support for the regent honeyeaters, but they don't go far enough. And they were able to isolate three key conservation priorities that are really necessary to secure the bird's future. So, first of all, the models showed the nest success rates of both wild and released zoo-bred birds needs to nearly double. So we need to protect those nests from predators. Secondly, the number of zoo-bred birds released into the Blue Mountains, which is where they're mostly being released now, need to increase. And they need to be sustained for at least 20 years alongside that nest protection. Now, Taronga Conservation Society, they've been breeding the birds in captivity and they're working really hard to increase numbers into the wild, which is really good. But thirdly, the model numbers, they stress that the regent honeyeater population can only be secured into the future if more habitat can be protected and restored. Without more habitat, reintroductions and nest protection efforts, they'll be futile because the flock sizes will never reach that critical mass number needed for the birds to breed safely in the wild without our protection. So these studies, they provide a bit of hope and a dire warning. We can save these birds, but it will take a lot of effort and resources over a long period of time to pull it off. It will absolutely be worth it, though. So fingers crossed we can put these recommendations into place.
Yeah, I know it'll be devastating to see another species disappear. So let's hope the really research yields a positive result.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed. Hopefully it will happen.
Yeah. Well, Ray Johnston, thank you very much for bringing us new, exciting developments in your field of work.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me.
That was journalist Ray Johnston in conversation with NITV Radio's Bejan Tungandame. The Australian government has secured the copyright license to the Aboriginal flag after the rights to the iconic design spent several years in private hands. The multi-million dollar deal with creator Luritja artist Arnold Thomas means the flag can now be used without a fee by general public and organisations and comes following a concerted campaign. Naveen Rasik reports.
It's distinctive, unique, and has been at the centre of some of Australia's most prominent events. It was flown as 250,000 people walked across the Sydney Harbour Bridge in support of reconciliation in 2000, and was draped across the shoulders of Cathy Freeman that same year when she won Olympic gold on home soil. The Aboriginal flag can be seen across Australia flying from schools, town halls, and at sporting fields. For much of its existence, the ownership and rights to the image have been contested. But now in a multi-million dollar deal, the copyright has been acquired by the Commonwealth. Ken White is the Minister for Indigenous Australians.
In short, we've freed the flag for our people to use it at any time, on any apparel or for any event. It also continues the commitment of the 50 years we've had in using the flag to be the symbol that unites us, brings us together for common good, but also in moments when people are protesting. But more importantly, it's available for all Australians.
Under the deal, the flag will be royalty-free. All Australians will have access to freely use the image on apparel, websites, in other works, without seeking permission, provided they use it in a respectful and dignified way. Its creator, Harold Thomas, will remain recognised as the author of the design.
I no longer will have copyright of the Aboriginal flag, but I still own the elements of it, the integrity of it, that it's my design.
In a pre-recorded statement, he said he's excited to see his creation made available for all.
It's freed up to be accessed for all sorts of people, all Australian people, mind you, not just Aboriginal, but it allows the Aboriginal flag to breathe a new life in itself, right? Breathe. So it becomes definitely in partnership with the Australian flag, and that I love.
Mr. Thomas was paid $2 million for both the copyright and to buy out existing commercial deals involving the flag. The exclusive rights to use the flag's design were sold to a group called Wham Clothing in late 2018 for an undisclosed sum. The company, which is not Indigenous, has been accused of sending cease and desist letters to organisations using the flag design as part of Indigenous commemoration events, including the AFL. The deal was scrutinised at a Senate hearing in 2020, where Green Senator Lydia Thorpe questioned company director Samile Moore about the acquisition of the copyright, receiving few answers.
Can you please talk us through the process that led to you holding the copyright?
It was due to an already existing relationship with Harold Thomas.
Could you elaborate?
No, we don't know.
For several years, there's been a campaign to free the flag, to allow anyone to use it for any purpose. Laura Thompson, co-founder of small business clothing The Gaps, began the campaign after her company received a cease and desist order for using the design on their apparel. She told ABC News she was extremely excited with the decision.
Lots of Aboriginal people and Australians in general believe that, you know, all flags belong to the public, but essentially the Aboriginal flag was and is privately owned, and now, you know, with this announcement, the Aboriginal flag's free for everyone to use, and that's so exciting, and I think we're going to see the Aboriginal flag flying again like it once did, and for people to enjoy proudly.
The deal came about without changes to legislation. Professor Kimberly Weatherall from the University of Sydney says the legal saga surrounding the flag has been messy.
The case certainly does show that copyright, with its emphasis on and considerable powers given to individual copyright owners, is a really poor fit for important symbols and symbolic works. And it's also a very poor fit for a lot of Indigenous art where there are communal interests as well as individual interests. And certainly too, if Australian copyright law had better exceptions, like a fair use exception or a proper quotation exception, those exceptions wouldn't have solved all of the controversies that were arising in relation to the flag, but they could have solved some of the problems and enabled especially some important non-commercial and symbolic uses.
Under the new deal, future royalties from the sale of the flag by its official manufacturer will go towards the work of NAIDOC, while an annual scholarship in Mr. Thomas's name will be set up. Mr. Thomas intends to use the $2 million payment to establish a not-for-profit organisation aligned with the flag. Labor's Indigenous Affairs spokeswoman Linda Burney has welcomed the move, but says there are still questions to be answered about the ownership deal.
I think it's important that we see a representative group of people be involved in determinations about the flag. I'm not quite sure what the plans are in relation to how it's going to be administered. The Prime Minister said it'll be administered in much in the way as the Australian flag is, but we need to remember that this is an officially recognised flag of Australia and therefore hugely significant.
That was Labour's Indigenous Affairs spokeswoman Linda Burney, ending this report by Naveen Razik for SBS News. And that's all from today's show. You are listening to NITV Radio, and my name is Sharka Pechová. Catch up with our podcast, head to our webpage sbs.com.au/NITV Radio, and we'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.